Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Sunday night, January the 6th. We continue our conversation with Dr. Frank Beckwith on the moral and legal arguments against abortion. He raised some ideas in the last hour that I'm saving here for the second hour, including what I think may be one of the stronger arguments for abortion, although I completely disagree with it, but I'm hearing it more and more, and I think it's a new one. We'll bounce it off of him a little bit later in this hour. We'll also take your phone calls and your email. Now, by the way, all of our lines are lit, and that means if you call now, you get a busy signal. But if you keep calling, we're going to free up phone lines very soon. 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, we get email right here in the studio. We can respond in real time. issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. And our call-in number again, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Frank Beckwith is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Jurisprudence at Baylor University, author of the new book we're giving away to our listeners tonight, Defending Life. Dr. Beckwith, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk with Lucas, who's calling from O'Fallon, Missouri, and listens on KSIV. Hi, Lucas.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
My question is, what is your view on this? Because my brother's wife, I'm completely against abortion, but she was pregnant back in 2005 with twins, and they were conjoined and sharing one heart. And they said if she would have tried to deliver the baby that she would have died. And I was wondering if this is a justified abortion or if it's still immoral and what your guys' views on this is.
Well, that's a great question. Thank you so much, Lucas. Dr. Beckwith.
That's a great question. Not having all the facts of the case before me, I'll just give you what I think is the right way for, you know, not everyone's going to agree with me on this, but this is the way I think the pro-lifer ought to proceed. We have to ask ourselves this question. When confronted with a difficult situation with certain principles that we accept and believe to be true, what is the best way to act so as to do our best? That is to say, to do the good that we can do. And supposing in this case, everything the caller said is in fact true, that there is no way that all three individuals could live. It will come down to, in such cases, for a physician to have to make a judgment about terminating the pregnancy early, or at least making sure the development of one of the children is such that both cannot mature. That's the sort of judgment that only is difficult if, in fact, you have a sanctity of life ethic. That is, it is not unlike a situation that maybe that, let's say, a policeman or a fireman may face of, let's say, deciding who to take out of a burning building, or let's say somebody in the infantry making a judgment as to what fallen comrades ought to be taken to the medic. All these things involve not a sort of arbitrary or capricious acting, but trying to figure out what precisely we should do given the difficult circumstances that we're in. So one of the things I want the caller to understand, though, is that these sorts of cases, which are often brought to the attention of pro-lifers, don't count against the pro-life position. And I'm not saying that's what he intended it to suggest, but pro-lifers are often given these difficult cases as an attempt to show that the pro-life position is not successful. I think what it does show, and this is the case in not only abortion but in other cases, that sometimes we have to make judgments as individuals living in a fallen world. After all, the ordinary pregnancy is not like that. The ordinary pregnancy is a healthy woman with a healthy child. And what the abortion rights position is that it is permissible to kill the child at that time and during under those circumstances.
Legally, talk, if you would, about how ill-advised it is to base law generally applied to the most normal cases upon extreme cases.
Yeah, it is. It's a very bad way to apply law, precisely because most ordinary cases are not like the exceptional cases. Like, imagine this. Imagine if, you know, let's say my wife is pregnant and I have to rush her to the hospital and I speed, and the police officer pulls me over and he, let's say, helps, but he doesn't give me a ticket. That just because I may be, let's say, justified in that circumstance to speed to get my wife to the hospital in time doesn't mean I have a right to speed if I need to go get groceries. It's a completely different circumstance. The principle is the same. I'm going to do what is consistent with the greater good. But at the end of the day, the general principle applies in ordinary circumstances. And this is why philosophers will refer to cases as prima facie. That's Latin for on the face of it, or what we would say ordinary circumstances. You know, it would be like, and I use this illustration in the book, imagine if we were debating whether to remove, let's say, one's grandparent from extraordinary care, and so some members of the family thought we should, and some people say we shouldn't. That doesn't mean that it's okay to kill grandpa if he was jumping around and having a good time. You know, these sorts of things occur in life as a consequence of the principles that we have given the fallen world that we live in. But that's right. I mean, if we were to take those exceptional circumstances and say, oh, because there may be cases where we can withdraw health care when people are dying, therefore it's okay to starve people who are healthy, that would be ridiculous.
Michelle listens in Chicago on WYLL. Hi, Michelle.
Hello. Good evening. I'm so glad that I tuned into the program. I just want to make a comment just about the last thing that Professor Beckwith said, and that pro-lifers are confronted with difficult issues. And I was confronted with a difficult issue when my 16-year-old was 16. She was pregnant. And being a born-again believer and knowing the consequences of breaking God's law, it's better to go on and have the baby, because when you're not married and you commit an adult act, then this is the consequence. This is absolutely the consequence. And I also believe, as the Word of God says, I am God and I changeth not. And there are going to be difficult circumstances that we're confronted with. But we have to know that God is sovereign and God is with us, and everything will be taken care of. Out of obedience and out of love to Him, it's going to be all right.
Michelle, thank you so much, and thanks for listening on WYLL in Chicago. Dr. Well, Beckwith, your thoughts?
Wow, what a courageous woman. I mean, that sort of example for a Christian to show to one's community and to share that on the air is deeply moving, and it's an encouraging thing to hear, and it is something that I think we have to be reminded that sometimes, in fact, many times, doing the right thing is not necessarily doing the thing that we prefer. That doing good is better to be—it's better to do good than it is to just merely be thought of as good. And this woman and her daughter exemplify that, and I commend them for their courage.
Chris is listening in Sioux City, Iowa on KTFC. Chris, we got about a minute before this break.
All right. Just a quick question. It was kind of answered by Lucas, but also with the extraordinary circumstances when you have a healthy mother and a healthy child, but then somehow during the pregnancy they find out that the baby will end up killing the mother. I mean, it's hard for me to justify that, knowing, I mean, it's one life or the other. How do you choose is really, I guess, my question. I mean, Chris, how do you draw the line?
Chris, thank you very much. Dr. Beckwith, I'll give you about 30 seconds to begin
a
response.
Real quick, these sorts of questions, we have to remember that when we talk about these sort of abstract examples like this, in order for me to properly answer it, I'd have to know the actual details of the case. But having said that, in these cases, typically, it really comes down to that if the pregnancy continues, then both will die. And so when the pregnancy is terminated, the intent is not to kill the fetus. The intent is to save a life, with the fetus's death being a foreseeable, though unintended, consequence, and that's how it's justified.
All right, when we come back, I want to pick up on that, because there is a twisting of that particular way of thinking that Dr. Beckwith just articulated in the pro-choice community. It comes down to their version of kind of a lesser of two evils. They'll say, look, abortion's evil, it's wrong. But it would be wronger, I coin a word here, it would be more wrong to bring the child into the world or to ruin the life of the mother. And they basically say, we're just choosing the lesser of two evils. We'll get Dr. Beckwith's response after this. Join Issues Etc. as we broadcast live from the annual symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's January 15th through the 18th. For a complete list of speakers, symposia schedule, or to register online, check out the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call 260-452-2241. It's the symposia, January 15th through the 18th, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne.
Anger, self-pity, loneliness, addiction, suffering, and suicide are just some of the topics covered in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's titled Visitation. You can find out more on our website, issuesetc.org, or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Arthur Just is the co-editor of this devotional resource. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Visitation.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172, or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Beginning of the year is a time when many Christians are looking for kind of that new devotional resource to start off the year to carry them through 2008. In this case, we've got it for you. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's titled simply Visitation. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also find out more about this book, Visitation, at our website, issuesetc.org. Visitation, it's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. Picking up on your response to the last caller, Dr. Beckwith, there has been, I think I'm detecting more and more use of this kind of argument, or at least implications of this kind of argument, in the pro-choice community. An attempt to co-opt the lesser of two evils argument. Now we have adamantly pro-choice people admitting that abortion is wrong, maybe even evil, and then they go on to make the necessary evil or the lesser of two evils argument by saying, look, it certainly is wrong to abort a child, but it would be more wrong to bring that child into the world under these circumstances, or more wrong to completely derail the life of the mother, or more wrong to send this child into a life of poverty or unwantedness. How do we respond to this?
Well, what the argument does, it assumes that the fetus or the unborn is not fully a human being or not fully a person, because that sort of argument would never work if it were applied to children that are already born. That is, imagine a situation where a child is in fact brought into the world in good circumstances with a good family, and let's say at the age of 3 or 4, that entire world crumbles. The person, let's say the child, becomes a victim of poverty, the parents divorce, and horrible things happen. We wouldn't say, at that point, we should kill the child so that it doesn't grow up and mature in what clearly looks like a life of destitution. Why? Because we don't think the 3 or 4 year old's right to life should be abdicated simply because it may benefit others, or that that person may be quote unquote benefited by their absence in the world. This is a way of reasoning that we would never countenance to people concerning people that are already born. So the one thing I tell pro-lifers is to just, when these sorts of examples are given, just simply change the character from the unborn to somebody that is already born, a child, an adult, etc., and see if the principle applies. And it clearly doesn't. There's another problem with this, that the circumstances that one finds oneself is different in terms of morality than how one acts. That is, it is one thing to find myself in a state of poverty. It is quite another for me to create somebody's state of poverty. That is, there's nothing immoral about being born into poverty. What's immoral is making people poor on purpose. That's not the case here. It isn't a debate or a decision to, oh, should we have make the child live or make him poor? It's not up to you to make him anything. What you have is a human being whose dignity ought to be respected. And to say that somehow they lack dignity because they may grow up poor is to actually imply that those that are already poor, those that are already in bad circumstances, have less dignity and sanctity than those who are well off. I can't think of anything more prejudiced or bigoted to think than to put that type of mindset in the general public.
Jeremy's listening in Oklahoma City on KQCV. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, gentlemen. How are you this evening?
Very well.
Great. Great. I kind of just, I guess it's more of like a middle ground comment and wondering how you would dialogue with somebody that reasons when a person's life ends is when their heart stops beating. So when their life begins is when their heart starts to beat.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's a very good question. Does it have something to do with the fact, Dr. Beckwith, that you got to have a heart to begin with?
Well, you know, the problem is that actually it's a very good pro-life argument in the sense that the heart, we have a detect a heartbeat very early within the first 3 weeks of pregnancy, which would mean that the only time abortion would be justified would be very, very early on. The problem, though, is the heart is not an essential organ for a living organism to continue to survive. We know this because let's say in the case of triple or quadruple or any bypass surgery, a person's heart literally stops. It's removed and operated on. Heart transplants occur in which literally the person has no beating heart, and yet that person is alive. And in fact, if one were to, let's say, kill the person in that state or, let's say, end life support, that would in fact be murder. So it turns out that the heart, although obviously a vital organ, given our technology, is in fact not essential. This is the case very early on, too, in the development of a human being. Before the heart develops, you have a living human being. So it's clear that although during most of its existence a human being needs a heart, it need not have one always in order to be a living organism.
So, in other words, the simplest explanation would be, generally speaking, yes, but there is a time in human development where a heart is not required, and is not present. When the heart is present, then it is required.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, what I think a lot of people tend to do is to come up with a kind of ideal human being, and they say, well, the fetus lacks, let's say, this particular organ because the ideal human being has that organ, let's say a 25-year-old male or something like that. The problem with that is that begs the question because one could say, well, yeah, human beings, in fact, at age 25 need hearts, but they don't need it at 2 weeks. That's just the way we are as organisms.
Scott is listening on KCCV in Kansas City. Hi, Scott.
Hello, gentlemen. Great show tonight. Just a quick comment on the previous caller. as far as I believe we should always look to our Heavenly Father, and not just doctors who say that, you know, the mother will not survive the pregnancy, because how many times are they wrong, you know? And so always seek our Heavenly Father for acknowledge Him in all things, and not just take the doctor's word for it. But my other comment was, bear with me just for a very, very short story. If you're walking down the street and you see someone attacking a three-year-old toddler, and you go over and you try to stop that, and the attacker falls and hits his head, and he dies, in our Heavenly Father's eyes, you are innocent, are you not? Okay, if that's the case, aside from man's law today, if someone take that analogy over to an abortion doctor, and what is wrong in our Heavenly Father's eyes to take the life of an abortion doctor?
All right, Scott. Now, he raises a question that has obvious widespread legal ramifications. But let's start with the simple question. What's wrong with taking the life of an abortion doctor if he's intent upon aborting?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons why it would be wrong. One, we have to remember that we live in a regime that has the rule of law. And even though abortion is deeply immoral and, I believe, a case of unjustified homicide, we have to remember that the law and order of society itself is valuable to protecting far more lives throughout the republic. So we have to. That doesn't mean that civil disobedience is never justified, but in the case of abortion, you have to ask yourself if, in fact, and I think this is one of the reasons why Operation Rescue, although I had many friends involved with it. I think ultimately didn't work was because there is a sense that if you're going to persuade your fellow citizens to change their mind on abortion, sometimes being radical is not the best way. Let me just put it this way.
We've got about 10 seconds here.
There's a principled reason why one ought not to do it. That is that we should respect the law, and secondly, I think practically it doesn't really work in the long run to protect as many lives as people think.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. When we come back, we've got 25 more minutes with him. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy and Jurisprudence at Baylor University, author of the new book, Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion Choice.
What we do in times like this is pay close attention and recognize in it God's alien work to drive us to Jesus.
Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, on what Christians should know during times of disaster.
We should rejoice over our relationship with Christ, over our relationship with our family. We should speak forgiveness to those whom we have sinned against and those who have sinned against us. We should be quick to think about eternal things and not the ridiculous things that ball us up and bog us down, which are necessary for life, but rejoice in the eternal verities which sustain us.
For more information about LCMS World Relief, go to the Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org, or call 314-996-1683, LCMS World Relief.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again, talking with Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, about the world's AIDS crisis. Matt, talk about how the AIDS crisis especially affects children.
Nearly 20% of AIDS deaths are children. Children who, through absolutely no ethical or moral fault of their own, have this curse upon them. And these are children where it's very easy to look upon them in pictures and say, well, they are those children. But then you meet them, each one of them, and you hear each one's name. And you talk to them about where they go to church and what they dream about and what they would like to have in their little lives. Something as simple as a chair, let alone a toy or a bed or somebody who loves them. and you can't but respond.
How is LCMS World Relief and the many who support it, how are they responding to this crisis?
Traditionally, we've done most of the response by way of education. That is, we've provided resources to our partners, many in Africa, but also AIDS in Thailand becomes a real challenge, is becoming an extreme challenge, and also in Russia, providing dollars so that pastors, church workers, health workers can be trained on AIDS. So education is very important, and we believe education is really key within a strong Lutheran context of law and gospel, and one that has a proper understanding of sexuality as God's gift, and the blessings that God gives us there, and the blessings of faithfulness and monogamy. So that has been important. We have, in the last several years, been very active with several orphanages in Kenya, and that has been just a wonderful joy. We just finished building a brand-new orphanage that houses about 60 children. It's amazing. For about $30,000, we were able to build a complete orphanage. We just added to the Matango Orphanage in western Kenya an entire medical clinic for really very little money comparatively. And we're increasingly going in this direction, providing resources for congregations in Africa so they can deal with their own HIV/AIDS orphans.
LCMS World Relief offers Christ-centered, cross-focused help to victims of the world's AIDS crisis. For more information about LCMS World Relief, find them at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438. LCMS World Relief, concerned for both body and soul.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Seminary St. Louis. They're going to be hosting Taste of the SEM January the 19th through the 21st. Now, Taste of the SEM is an opportunity for high school-aged men to experience seminary life briefly. They see the classroom, they meet the professors, the whole nine yards, and then they can use that as a basis for deciding in the future on a path towards studying for the ministry. To find out how you can send a young man from your congregation to Taste of the SEM, look for information under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Seminary St. Louis, 1-800-822-9545. Taste of the SEM, January 19th through the 21st at Concordia Seminary St. Louis. We're talking about moral and legal arguments against abortion tonight with Dr. Frank Beckwith. Holly listens in Green Bay, Wisconsin on WEMY. Hi, Holly.
Hi, gentlemen, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk, Dr. DeBeck. I think the man that was on earlier, just a little while ago, about 5 or 10 minutes ago, he said a 3-year-old was on the street and a man attacking him, and he falls down, hits his head and dies, and then you're attacking him, and he hits his head and he dies. I can't remember what he said exactly there at that point, but he said he compared it to an abortion doctor. I think biblically, I am a Christian. I'm a born again Christian. I do believe in the power of God and the Spirit of God, and I do believe in them types of things. They do me very well in life, and they've done me very well. God has done miracles in my life. But, well, the issue I want to get to in that respect is that it says follow man's laws and it says follow God's laws, but follow man's laws until they conflict with God's. You don't take the power of God into your own hands to kill an abortion doctor like you would someone attacking a 3-year-old. That's the point I really wanted to make.
All right. Holly, thank you very much, and thanks for waiting there on the line. Dr. Beckwith.
Yeah, that was, I think, an excellent observation that there's a fundamental difference between taking the law into your own hands to do what you think is just versus, let's say, saving a life consistent with what is already legal. So if, let's say, you were to intervene, let's say, with an adult harming a child, that's perfectly legal to do that. It is not legal to take the law into your own hands and to kill an abortion doctor. It's, in fact, to do the very thing that we as Christians and pro-lifers believe is wrong, namely to willfully disregard the dignity of the person, And so, I think that the caller put it very well, that at the end of the day, that it is God's universe and His, and He's the one who instituted the government. And so we have to have a respect for the rule of law. Christians in times past didn't live in liberal democracies like we do, and they wouldn't, in fact, have even entertained the possibility of breaking the law.
Listening on KFAX in Berkeley, California, here's Lynn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. I have a relative who doesn't like the idea of abortion but strongly supports keeping it legal because they want every child a wanted child, not born into a neglectful or abusive home. That kind of stumps me because that is at least a somewhat reasonable argument. But what are your suggestions for discussing abortion with someone with such a perspective?
Lynn, you read my mind. You know, when that phrase, Dr. Beckwith, came out, every child a wanted child.
Yeah.
At first it sounds so good, and then you realize in order for every child to be a wanted child, the unwanted ones are going to be exterminated. And then, of course, every child is a wanted child. It is grisly.
That's right. I think there are a couple of things that originally occurred to me when I first heard that argument, and some of which I share in the book. First, to say that a child's dignity and respect is contingent upon another person wanting it is, in fact, to diminish the value of that child instantly. Mm-hmm. It's to treat a child as if it were an object. Think about it. Things like refrigerators and computers and cars and radios and telephones, those are the sorts of things that we want or unwant, and we don't think the dignity of those things are diminished because of our wanting or not wanting them. But human beings are different. When we treat human beings as objects rather than subjects, we, in fact, undermine the dignity of that person. At the end of the day, this argument, like so many of the others we've gone over, assumes that the unborn is, in fact, not a full-fledged member of the human community, because if it were, we wouldn't accept that argument. If we were to, let's say, discover that the woman down the street or the man down the street killed their five-year-old because they didn't want it, the child anymore, we would think that's terrible, that child's value is not contingent upon the parents wanting it. Why does that apply to the unborn? Well, because what's smuggled in is the assumption that the unborn is not a person, which of course means that's really the issue. Is it a person? And if it is a person, that argument doesn't work.
Keith in North Platte, Nebraska emails us. This is what he has to say. I've reviewed the current presidential candidates concerning their position on abortion, and I'm disturbed by all of them. I've not found a single instance of a pro-life candidate who has stated exactly why they are opposed to abortion. I've encountered references to gruesome procedures and sanctity of life, but nothing that makes clear exactly what the problem with abortion is. I have emailed the Republican candidates with a simple question: is abortion murder? To date, I have not gotten a single affirmative response. If abortion is not murder, what other reason do these candidates have for opposing it?
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
That's a very good observation. I reminded of a friend of mine who has told me that about the first President Bush. He said he did a lot for the pro-life movement, but he was all action and no talk. And what he meant by that was that even though some of these folks who are running, I think, will clearly help the pro-life cause in terms of what they will do in the Oval Office, we do need, I think, rhetorically, better representatives of the pro-life position running for national office. I would like to see, for example, one of the candidates who is pro-life to explain clearly why he or she is pro-life. This rarely happens. You usually hear, well, this is my position. But the real important question, and I think the writer nails it, is not really that they believe something or what they're willing to defend legislatively or what they'll do in the Oval Office, but why do they believe it? I remember years ago when Ronald Reagan was president, 1984, he published a small book called Abortion and the Conscience of the Nation. This was a sitting president who offered a clear and concise defense of the pro-life position. I think a question that would be wonderful to ask one of these candidates, especially the Republicans: have you read President Reagan's small book? And if you have, do you agree with it? That would be a great question to ask. It's a very easy, you can read the book in an hour and a half. It's a very small hardback that It's maybe 100 pages, but in any event, I do think that the writer makes a very, very good point.
Roger in Minnetonka, Minnesota, listens on KKMS. He also writes us saying this: how can pro-abortion people say that what they are killing is not a human life? Everyone who is living was in the same position once as those unborn humans. Actually, since this is the case, those doctors performing abortions are guilty of murder, and the women getting them are co-conspirators. I really don't know if it's necessary to take it that far, though I may tend to go that way, to charge them with murder. But isn't it obvious that laws need to be made to represent the fact that unborn babies in any state of development are human? How can it be that unborn animals that some people consider to be endangered have very harsh punishments for destroying them, while it's just a relatively small amount of money to pay to kill a human during an abortion? How can they justify abortion? Several questions there, and an idea we hadn't entertained yet so far. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Let me just address very briefly the question of legal penalties, which I think is sort of wrapped in those series of questions, and it's an important one. If abortion were to become illegal, how would we penalize people who, in fact, engaged in abortion? And I think the key to understanding how to answer that is to look at what the penalties were prior to Roe v. Wade. That is, when abortion was in fact illegal and considered to be an act of homicide. And it will surprise many people to hear this, but in virtually every jurisdiction, the woman was provided with some type of immunity if in fact she turned in the physician. And there was, the thinking was two-pronged here. One, when you have all the participants as witnesses, you're never going to get a conviction. So you need to have one of them be the person that, in fact, reveals who, in fact, participated. And secondly, the thinking was the woman herself is a type of second victim. That is, if a person does this sort of desperate act, the law recognizes that they may have not been totally have their right mind about them or something like that. Now, there's a paternalistic aspect to that, certainly, but I do think that if, in fact, Roe v. Wade were overturned, that in some jurisdictions, if abortion were to become illegal, we would have penalties whose purpose wasn't merely to punish people, but to teach the lesson that abortion is wrong and to limit the number of abortions that would be performed. And we have to remember that penalties don't always directly reflect the severity of the act. Sometimes we make the penalties lighter or stronger depending on how we can best end the crimes. This occurred in the early 20th century when the federal government made kidnapping a capital crime. You know what happened as a result of that? Many kidnapped children were killed. Because the kidnappers thought that, well, if, you know, better to get rid of the witness than to, I'm going to suffer the death penalty anyways. So we have to remember that penalties have to be calibrated to achieve certain consequences. So I think that's what would happen. In terms of the other comments.
Well, let's pick up on that on the other side of the break, and we'll go to his question about the destruction of endangered species in utero, as opposed to the destruction of human beings in utero. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. When we come back, 10 more minutes with him.
Why not send a high school age man from your congregation to Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, on the campus of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis? Taste of the Sim gives high school men the opportunity to experience seminary life. For more information on Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, visit the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call 1-800-822-9545. If you enjoy listening to Issues Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours weekdays on the Internet? Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click Listen Online, and you'll find 12 new hours Monday through Friday. You can listen live on your PC or on demand or on your iPod or MP3 player. Issuesetc.org, and tune in weekdays to 12 new hours of Issues Etc.
Where Christianity meets culture.
You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. Carl Fekincher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on good reasons to become a pastor.
Before I went to the seminary, I worked in business for a number of years, and I enjoyed very much what I was doing, but I realized that the aspects of my jobs that I appreciated the most certainly were the opportunities to be helpful and encouraging and supportive of the people who worked with me. And it was quite clear to me, without any question, that the way I could be most helpful to them was sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, their Savior. And I realized that if I became a pastor, that would be what I'd do all the time, and I would never be restricted in any way in what I could say. The help that I could bring to people that I cared about would be the help that was not just for today or tomorrow, but eternal.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. 10 more minutes with Dr. Frank Beckwith, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Jurisprudence at Baylor University, author of the book Defending Life. Dr. Beckwith, before the break, we had an emailer. The second question that we didn't have time to get to, and if we could briefly, noticed the odd juxtaposition of the destruction of endangered species in utero being considered crimes with harsh punishments, where no punishment to very little punishment for the same destruction of human embryos.
That's a really good observation. I think what you have here with the caller's question, or the writer's question, or the caller's question, I'm sorry, you have an understanding that when it comes to endangered species, let's say the humpback whale, or something like that, that entity in utero is identical to the entity that's already born. So that's why the law would apply equally to both the unborn version as well as the one that's already born. And of course, if that's the case with other mammals, it would follow that human beings are in exactly the same position.
Paul in Milwaukee listens on WRRD, and he says this: does history offer examples of rationalizations of abortion that have led to the offing of others deemed inconvenient, undesirable, or unproductive? I'm thinking of the crippled, mentally deficient, or elderly in the Soviet Union, the Third Reich. Did statist abuse and killing of these last groups lead to abortion? Has the quality of life concept influenced Western jurisprudence in this respect?
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt that what you have coming out of at least the late 19th century, early 20th century, the influence of a lot of contemporary atheism, or what eventually becomes contemporary atheism, and the naturalist or materialist understanding of human beings influences European culture, and you get a number of the atrocities that we've seen in the 20th century. For example, in the early 20th century, there was a famous article called, in German, On Lives Not Worth Living. And it's an article by a German physician and I think a German philosopher, in which they make the argument for removing and killing handicapped children, as well as others, adults who are dependent on the state who cannot live on their own. Now, what's interesting about that article, I took that a piece of that or a couple of sentences of it and read those sentences to a pro-life group, and then read a quote from a contemporary bioethicist, and I asked them, which of the two was the contemporary bioethicist? And most of them picked the early 20th century German writers. And then when I told them that these were the precursors to the Nazis, they let out a gasp in the audience. And what I was trying to show them is that these ideas had consequences. That is, these ideas, they sound to us today, maybe like some really sophisticated guy on Nightline defending active euthanasia. But at the end of the day, what it eventually spawned was a type of killing that we find to be repugnant. But we have to understand that these actions didn't occur in a vacuum. They're the consequence of beliefs about human beings that had their beginnings at a time when people were becoming skeptical about everything about human dignity that they thought correctly was tied to the Christian and biblical view of reality.
Dan listens here in St. Louis on KSIV. Hi, Dan.
Thank you very much for the great show. When Roe was decided, even the majority opinion written by Justice Blackmun,
yes,
left open the possibility and stated that the reason this court came down that way was they didn't know when life began. And, of course, they didn't have the technology then to see the life of a child as it is now, as we know it's alive. But he left open the possibility in the decision that the court was open to a different decision if and when a decision was made as to when life began. And it seems to me that, does that require a constitutional amendment stating when life begins, or can that just simply be an action by Congress and signed by a president?
Very good question, Dan. Thank you very much. Glad to get that one in.
That
Dr. Beckwith.
That is a great question. He is absolutely correct in terms of if he's in fact implying that the Congress could pass legislation and the president signed it, absolutely it could occur. What the Congress could do, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment gives it the power to enact or to apply the Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which talks about life, liberty, and that one's life, liberty, and property cannot be taken from you without due process of law. The Congress could easily do that right now, and the president could sign it into law. You don't need a constitutional amendment. Now, clearly, there are going to be some people who will challenge that and ironically would have to go to the Supreme Court, and it would be one of those cases where the Supreme Court would have to decide whether another branch of government can decide the parameters of its power, which we've had a couple of these sorts of cases in the past. But the caller raises a very, very interesting constitutional question, and I personally, and I'm not the only legal scholar who thinks this way, a number think that, in fact, the Congress could do it right now if it wanted to.
Two quick final questions. We hear a lot from the pro-choice community now about reducing the number of abortions. In fact, I think Senator Hillary Clinton has even conceded in a town hall meeting that she would be happy to reduce the number of abortions to zero.
Yeah.
And she says this is where pro-life and pro-choice can come together to reduce the number of abortions. And while I'm in favor of that, I don't think anybody isn't, it does seem to me from the pro-choice side to be a bit of a red herring. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think there's something odd about it in this sense. If you have a right to do something, why would you want less of it? I mean, we don't say that about other rights. We don't say, I believe in freedom of religion, but I'd like to see fewer people go to church. I mean, nobody says that. If this is really a right, then it's a good. And if it's a good, why would you think that it's something bad? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, I know why she's saying it, and I know why other candidates make similar comments, that is that they're able to sort of take care of pro-lifers who may vote for them, and this is a way to sort of play down the criticism. But at the end of the day, it seems kind of odd to say that you want it, safe and
legal.
Rare.
Yeah, what, safe, legal, and rare.
Safe, legal, and rare. I mean, can you imagine if somebody said that about torture? You know, Guantanamo Bay, I'm against, but I just want safe, legal, and rare.
Finally, then, with only 30 seconds, how do you respond to the argument that if abortion is ruled unconstitutional, we'll simply go back to the back alley coat hanger abortions?
Yeah, that's a question, believe it or not, you hear less of today, but once in a while you do hear it. The problem with the argument is two-pronged. One, it assumes, like so many of the arguments we've gone over, assumes that the unborn is not a person, which, of course, is the question. If the unborn is a person, then the argument doesn't work. In fact, it's not even necessary. If the unborn isn't a person, the argument's unnecessary. If it is a person, it's irrelevant. So the argument doesn't really establish the pro-choice position at all. Secondly, if you want to look at the numbers prior to Roe v. Wade, in fact, legalized abortion increased not only the number of abortions, but also a consequence was more unwed, more children sired out of wedlock. And the reason for this is that something that the pro-choice movement didn't anticipate, that a lot of women who were using contraception did not, when they got pregnant, think of abortion as a fallback position. It was something they thought they could do, but then once they got pregnant and thought about the child living inside them, they decided to have the child, in many cases, out of wedlock. So legalization of abortion not only resulted in more abortions, it resulted in more children born out of wedlock. It's been a social and political disaster.
1-800-737-0172 is the phone number for our resource line. You can use that number to request a free copy of the Next Issues Etc. journal. You can also use that number to stand with us as we defend life from beginning to end by making a tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. 1-800-737-0172. You can also sign up online, issuesetc.org, or just write us, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Dr. Frank Beckwith is a regular guest, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Jurisprudence at Baylor University and author of the new book, Defending Life. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thanks for having me. I very much appreciate it.
You know, the best reason to be pro-life, or we could even say pro-unborn, because really in the case of abortion, we're talking about unborn life, but life nonetheless. Jesus defines the neighbor not from the top down, not from the people who can do the most for you down. Jesus defines the neighbor from the bottom up, those who can't do anything for you, who are helpless, defenseless. And if we are to love our neighbor, which no one would argue that loving your neighbor is a bad thing, if we are to love and defend and protect our neighbor, we begin from the bottom up, from those most helpless, most defenseless, least able to do anything for you. And that certainly, most certainly includes the unborn. Yes, they are our neighbors. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen each week to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of Worldwide KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.